Hi everyone and welcome to Inside Classics. I'm Ayelet Khamzun-Lushkov, joined as always by Sam Ross and Cassie Winkley. The episode you're about to hear was recorded almost a year ago in summer of 2020, and its publication was delayed for various boring reasons, but we offer it now in the hopes that the anniversary of the pandemic offers a good time for reflection on how things were, how things have been, and what we might still learn from it. We hope you enjoy.
All right, so what we wanted to talk about today in our digressive, informal way is kind of a check-in with you guys about how we deal with, what was it, Sam? Like, we had a very amorphous, like, grad student, job market, new faculty, kind of, things that are new during the pandemic. So it can be a fairly broad free-for-all. And we'll just start by having you guys just say your names and who you are and what you do and stuff like that. So we have an intro soundbite.
Hi, I'm Bill Ferris. I'm a PhD student at UT. I've just finished my second year. I've been living in quarantine the past 2 months, like we all have. My wife is 37 weeks pregnant with number two, and I've just spent an inordinate amount of time thinking about obscure Hellenistic poetry and trying to say something clear about it. So,
hi, I'm Naomi Campa. I'm an assistant professor of classics, soon to be, at University of Texas. In waiting. We're engaged.
Yes.
I also have been semi-quarantined, I suppose, as most people have. I have a five-month-old infant at home, so I have some challenges with that in the quarantine. And I think about ancient political theory and intellectual history, mostly. And also the optative, because it's fun.
What that it was?
Yeah. We're starting off strong with grammar jokes. People are going to love us. I'm Colin McCormick. I'm a grad student at UT. Like everyone else, I've been isolating and quarantining. I don't know how long, but I'm here with a six-year-old cat named Leo. And I spend most of my time writing, reading, and then trying to write about animals in ancient thought and the way people like to tell stories about animals.
And you're also a Mellon fellow.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I'm a fellow in for the Andrew Mellon Foundation's Engaged Scholars Initiative, which is dedicated to thinking about sort of public scholarship and public facing scholars.
And so, Colin, are you on your own? Is it just you and Leo?
Yeah. So I was living with another grad student, Susan, but she just moved out a couple weeks ago. Actually, she moved in with her partner. So I'm actually in her former room right now. One of my projects, I've been keeping busy with home improvement. And so I painted this room, hung up all the art. And the piece de resistance of these curtains that just came yesterday.
You know that we have still hung up none of our art because we're still holding on to the dream that you will come around one day.
I can still do that. I mean, well, when I moved into this room, a lot of it basically involved, and so I moved like all of the furniture in the house, which meant all of the art had to move to like match the walls. Because my old job, I used to actually, before I was a grad student, I was like an art installer basically for 2 years.
So basically since Susan left you, have you been just on your own? Have you had any human interaction?
Actually, yeah. So my partner, Tracy, who's also socially distancing, but not too far away, we see each other somewhat regularly. And I also play a lot of sort of online games with people like 4 days a week. So I've had actually not as isolated an experience as you might think, even though it is just me by myself in this house with the cat.
What type of online games? Talk to each other.
Yeah. So the big ones is Dungeons and Dragons. I play that like constantly. Oh, okay. There was a bar in town that we used to play. Like one, I played with what was a group of strangers like once a week. But all of that just moved, and I used to bring people over to my house like once a week to play. And then, but we've all just since moved online. And since my brother also, him and his friends were kind of getting a little restless, so I started a game for them. So it's a bunch of like my brother's old college friends. But it's kind of, it's a tricky thing because it can suck up a lot of your time.
Yeah, I just joined my third campaign. So on the bright side though, quarantine's kind of encouraged me to like start games with people who don't live as close, who I wouldn't normally get to play with. So So it's not all bad, but.
So in contrast to you, you know, bachelor game playing dudes, I finally have parental company on this podcast.
Hi.
So How has the childcare situation been going for the two of you? I guess, Bill, let's start with you because you have one child and one impending child.
So my daughter turned 3 in April.
Yay!
So that might give you a hint of what it's like. I have to say it's not always fair because she likes her mom a lot more than me most of the time. So she has been distracting my wife a lot more than me. But I think the way that summed it up really well for me is there was a Facebook post a friend of mine posted who's a college professor parent. And the Facebook post was about how this person did a data set of trying to work for 3 hours and marked every single time in those 3 hours where one of the person's kids interrupted the work, basically. And the person said they got about 2.5 hours of work done within 3 hours, but they were interrupted 45 times. And I think I definitely knew what I meant, even if it's Ira, my daughter, not talking to me, but mom. She's like, hey, mom. Hey, mom. Hey, dad. Hey, dad. Hey, dad. So you can imagine trying to write, like, I don't know, a 20-page, 30-page research paper, and you're like in the middle of a paragraph or in the middle of a sentence, and then somebody comes up and says, hey, dad. Hey, dad. Hey, dad. Sometimes it goes different ways. So sometimes my daughter really wants attention. Sometimes she goes and plays by herself. So we got a sand, what do you call it? A big thing to put sand in.
I'm losing my word.
A sandbox, yeah.
Cat litter box.
The arena.
Yeah, a sandbox. And it's shaped like a turtle. And it's great. Yeah. And it fits on our balcony outside. And my daughter calls it the beach. And so like yesterday morning, she just played in the beach for a couple hours.
Yeah.
So that was nice. And
you can turn it into a mud box.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then like the rest of the day.
No, it's great. Yeah. And I'd say the other key thing for us that doesn't always work is getting her down for a 2-hour nap, which usually happens between 12:30 and 2:30, but sometimes doesn't happen.
Is it like a hostage negotiation situation? You have to like talk them down?
Definitely. Yeah. Go take a nap. I don't want to take a nap. some of my favorite ones are, my daughter has picked up the phrase, you're driving me crazy. yeah, that's what I get. But she'll get down eventually.
Ella has given up naps completely. Ella and Ira are in the same year in daycare. And the upside to that is that she now sleeps through the night. But we have had, like, the only reason we got our grades done is because we've had a few nights this week where she refused to go to bed. And so she was just up until 10:30. So we were like, we have to demonstrate that staying up is just not worth it. So we have to make it, like, super boring. And so we just sat at the dining table and did our grading. And Ella pulled out this old, like, the Dell computer, the Dell laptop that I wrote my dissertation on. So it's, like, 20-something. God, is 20 years old. But I didn't, you know, graduate 20 years ago. I just want to be clear. And she, like, set it up next to me and was like, I am doing very important work, and just banged on the keyboard for like an hour. And then at 10:30 had a meltdown and went to sleep. So yeah. But other than that, she just says, I'm gonna just watch TV and rest. And then she just frozen and does not rest. So yeah. I feel your pain, Bill, but if you're getting any nap at all, then you are way ahead.
Some days. When she doesn't take a nap, at midday, she will, like, it'll be like 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and she'll be sitting, like the other day it happened, she was sitting next to my wife, and in the middle of a sentence talking, she just conked out. you did remind me of another key strategy that has really helped, is that we got a Kindle for our daughter maybe a year ago or so that comes with a big kid case, so the kid can potentially throw it and it won't break. And we got it for like airplane travel and things, but it's come in really handy in quarantine when you just really need time and she won't sleep.
We asked Ella how come she sleeps in daycare and doesn't sleep at home. And she said, well, in daycare, the teachers don't let you wake up.
That's foreboding.
Yeah.
What's going on in daycare?
Yeah. I think what you meant, I hope what you meant, is that they don't let you get off your map. You have to stay on your map for an hour, and after an hour, you can go and play quietly in a corner.
Like in daycare, naps take you.
Yeah. She has not, the concept of quiet time has not worked for us. So when we're too soft, we let her wake up, whereas Miss Irene in daycare is a much firmer cop than us. And is your wife doing well? You said she's doing like 3 weeks?
Yeah, in about 2.5 weeks now.
So,
yeah.
Like any day now?
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So I'm personally glad that I'm done with my coursework now. And she teaches high school. I think next week is the last week she has any students doing any work. So yeah. It would be nice.
Good job on that timing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It would be nice to be done with next week too.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll see.
Yeah. Cool. And Naomi, how about you?
So my situation is a little different because my baby's still a baby, right? So he needs more attention in some ways, but a lot less in others. He's entertained much more easily than a toddler. My wife and I have talked about that a few times, how much easier it is for us than someone who has elementary school kids who are now doing homeschool teaching on top of everything else, or a toddler, which just needs constant entertainment. My wife is a medical resident, so she's still working because she's obviously an essential worker. And this semester, I took off teaching. So I worked up until the end of last semester in December and then took off. My son was born in December, so I planned to stay home this semester. So the quarantine in some ways didn't affect my life as immediately as other people, because I didn't have to suddenly change all my coursework online or deal with final grades or do any of that. My plan was already to kind of stay home and be the primary caretaker for this semester and then move in the summer, you know, to Austin, and then in the fall have childcare. So some of that has changed. We were going to have a little bit of help maybe once a week so I could continue to work on my book. And that has not been the case because my wife is working full time. So while she can help in the evening, sometimes it's really the baby and the home are my responsibility right now. So that was going to be like my release to have some time to work on my manuscript. Now it's been a little bit different. Obviously, you don't want anyone coming to the house. He takes naps, so that's good. But he is 5, almost 6 months. And for those of you who have not had infants, their sleep patterns, there are patterns, but it's a very loose word. They change rather quickly. So at the beginning of quarantine, he was sleeping great. He had this really, really long nap in the morning. And so I would get down and do my work during that time. Then the rest of the day, just really pay attention to him or do things I needed to do around the house, right? Prep dinner or laundry or all that kind of pedestrian stuff that we need to get done. And I live in Cleveland right now, so it wasn't possible to take a nice walk outside until very recently. It literally snowed in May. So just to give you a perspective of how trapped we can be. And I'm a total wuss with the cold. So I'm not going to go out there in a snowsuit and push him around in a stroller. It's just not going to happen.
It was 100 degrees here the other day. So
I know. I now have Austin on my, you know, my iPhone weather app. And I'm always like, oh,
I unfortunately am having to move from my apartment into my parents' house right now. So like having to carry stuff to my car in the heat is miserable.
Yeah, I am hoping that my blood hasn't thickened too much out here in the Midwest by the time we have to deal with 100 degree days. But I'm from Miami, which is an idyllic, you know, beautiful, perfect climate where it's usually 80s, maybe 90s, but not 110.
Yeah, I feel like the heat doesn't actually get easier to deal with no matter how long I've lived here. So,
you just desiccate outside.
Yeah, and like Cassie said, I'm moving next week, and I'm looking forward to it because we're in temporary housing now and it's cramped. The idea was that we'd only have all three kids here during a couple days of our spring break, which didn't prove to be the case.
Surprise.
So looking forward to moving, but also, as Cassie said, moving in the 100 degree heat and so is not appealing.
Not ideal.
No, when I first moved to Austin, I had been living in Houston and I was traveling and I left my car basically like in the parking lot for like a month. And when I came back, I found out that the car's AC, like I had to just drive with a car full of stuff from Houston to Austin. I found out that the AC had broke while I was just sitting in that parking lot. And it was just the miserable, like it was probably August. And it was just like that drive from Houston to Austin with no AC. And I felt so bad. My cat was like, just like dying in the car. It was the worst. And then you get there and then your prize is start moving in. Has your timeline changed for moving to Austin now, or is your plan still kind of the same?
So, well, our plan is still July, and part of that is because the timeline is partly dependent on my wife's timeline. She finishes residency at the end of June, so we couldn't move before then. And then she has to take her medical board exam, which is in July. So we were always kind of planning to do it around then. Now, there are some questions around that date because it is at a testing center, and because of COVID, you know, mm-hmm. social distancing, all that might be delayed. And then we also have a home we're putting for sale here. So those are kind of all the moving parts to get to Austin. So our goal is still July. That was our original goal. We're still being very hopeful. The difference is we might do just kind of a short-term rental when we first get there for a few months and then kind of see a mm-hmm. more permanent place to stay. Interestingly, because there's no travel right now, a lot of what appear to be Airbnb houses are now doing short-term rentals. Because they're not getting anyone coming for a week or a weekend. And so now the way they're trying to make some money is to make either furnished short-term housing. So we may look into something like that. So to finish the how to work stuff, his naps kind of determine a lot of what I do in my day. And so we've had some periods where he went through the famous 4-month regression where they have a little bit more trouble sleeping. It's a regression because they act like they're 1 month old again. So at the very beginning, they have a lot of trouble regulating their sleep because their brains aren't developed in that way yet. And then they kind of, you know, are able to learn how to do some more sleep. And then at 4 months, they're like, you know what? Nah, never mind. But it actually means that their brain is changing to be able to process sleep more like we do. So it's a good sign, but it's not a good sign when you're not sleeping. So that's been the challenge in terms of things that have worked. It's been really having realistic goals for me. And again, it's because I've had to really limit the time. And so instead of saying, I'm going to do 3 hours of writing today and beating myself up if I didn't get that time in, really making micro goals. I'm going to do this for 30 minutes. And if I get that 30 minutes done, then I have, you know, an extended goal I can reach towards. But I can also say, hey, I did my 30 minutes or whatever it is, or finish this article, you know, reading this article, annotating this article, or working on this one paragraph. Maybe I just really wanted to tinker with that one paragraph and then calling it a day. So that's been really, really helpful to me, is just to have more realistic goals. So, and shifting my own goals for what I wanted to accomplish on my book in the meantime, because I know some people have been able to do kind of switching off, right? Okay, I'll take the baby 9 to noon. You take the baby noon to 3. But I haven't really been able to do that. Right now, my wife is taking the baby because it's a Saturday. So she's able to be home, and she knew I had this podcast, so she was very kind. So that's another time I could work, but I refuse to work on weekends. So, especially in quarantine, because there's already no days, right? I don't have a class to go to. I already don't have a day. And it seems to me that if you give up your weekends, then you really start eroding all sense of normalcy and a work-life balance. Yeah. So it's been really important to me to set boundaries and say, okay, I'm not going to work on the weekends. I can do a lot of house projects. Colin, it sounds like you like doing that too. Yeah, I did some painting also. Actually, I love painting. I feel like painting a wall is one of the most satisfying activities you can do in your life.
Oh, yeah. It was like so cathartic to like finish and like look at it. And because it's the perfect balance of like, it wasn't like too hard. And like my partner was helping me, so that made it go a lot faster. But like, and then you just look and you've like got a complete thing that's done, which is when then you look at like the thing you're trying to write, which is much more nebulous. It's really nice to have something that's like, this was like this and now it's like this. There's like a marked difference.
Absolutely. For people who are not academics, the thing about academia is that you always have something to do. If you're writing something, you can always make it better. Or you feel like you could always learn a little bit more, read something else. And the thing with painting a wall is that when it's done, it is done. And it looks good. And like you said, it was A before and now it's B. It's been transformed by your hands.
The binariness is so refreshing. Yes.
Yeah. There is no in between. Yeah. It's either done or not. Yeah, absolutely. Well,
my husband and I were celebrating our day of jubilee yesterday because we submitted grades at 10 a.m. and we're like, okay, great, we're done for the term. And then I was like, well, so I have this like graduate prospectus to read and then Colin's chapter to read. And then, you know, there's a fundraiser on in the middle of June and then I'll be done with my obligations for the term, except that, you know, I should probably like prep like classes for next term and, you know, the two articles I'm like a year late on. And, you know, and by the time I got to the end of like just things that I had like signed a dotted line on, right, that I have committed to doing, not including book contracts or anything like that, I'm just like booked through, you know, well, the rate I'm going, 2023, because I have a 3-year-old and a 11-month-old. And let me tell you, two children is more than 200% of the childcare.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. And as I'm sure you guys have found out, if you get the nap just right, and it's in the morning and you're still awake and the laundry's done and the house is clean, then you can like do some work. But that doesn't happen to me anymore. So in the rare occasions when Theo's asleep and Elle's watching TV or, you know, God forbid, has agreed to take a nap, there's like a million things that like need to get done on a timeline. Like we have to eat and like we have to get the laundry, because there's always, once they hit three, there's always like a dress that they need to wear right now that is in the laundry from like 2 days ago.
Yep.
Or, you know, some weird substance to scrape off a wall or whatever it is. And when you're in quarantine, then you can't just ignore all the stuff around the house. It like you have to keep your environment in some sort of like basic hygienic state. And so by the time we've done that, it's like, you know, bedtime. And Pramit has, you know, his superpower is being able to stay up really late at night, but I'm done by 10:30. And so yeah, I've done very little, and most of it has been just kind of grading other people's work because I don't have the brain capacity for new stuff. So basically, Colin, the comments I put down on your chapter are my like top intellectual labor. So I hope you. But it's been a weird experience.
I feel super lucky not to have to grade. I feel like if I had to use brain power to grade, there's no way I could do any writing or reading for my own work because there's only that sliver of time. Yeah. I'm in a writing group, which has helped to kind of be accountable and take those little, that's given me a little bit of extra push to say, okay, I'm going to do this first before I even tackle something else. But it is tough because when you're at home, you're just staring at it.
Yeah.
For me, that drives me nuts. You know, whatever it is, like you said, whether it's the dishes or laundry or whatever it may be.
Yeah. Maybe. Have you found yourself making more elaborate like dinners and stuff? Because it's an excuse. It's like, you know, if you're cooking, then you can't possibly be expected to work.
That's a really easy way for me to cop out of my work all the time. I perfected it in grad school. So it's really easy for me to fall back on that crutch. And I really love to cook. So I've tried to rein it in. I've tried to do a balance. When my son was born, I kind of streamlined some of what I like to cook because I was just so tired at the beginning when you have a newborn. It really is like, I mean, I knew I'd be tired, but it's really something different. I mean, it's totally doable. It's, you can survive it. You can be happy during it, but it's unlike any other tired that I'd ever had, even doing crazy all-nighters in undergrad, or when I was in undergrad, I also worked a full-time job. So doing that, staying up all night, going to class, going back to work, it's a different kind of tired. It's also probably because now I'm old.
Well, and it's because you don't know when you'll sleep again, right? Even when you're doing shift work, you know that, okay, right now
you're
sleeping, but you know the next week you'll get right that sleep back. But with kids, you're just like, well, I just slept for 2 hours and like, God knows when this child, like Ella just in the last 4 months has started sleeping through the night. So, you know.
And then in comes Theo, like the wrecking ball.
He's actually a much better sleeper because like all second children, we just put him down and ignored him because otherwise I would throw a fit. So he actually has good sleep hygiene.
We just did get this on the record for Colton to record later. That's like Isla jinxes herself.
Now we have this crazy pattern where Theo goes to bed around 8:39 and he sleeps until like anywhere from 10:30 to 12, at which point he wakes up and he just wants me, right? So if Pramit goes in there, he will just scream his head off. So Pramit goes in there and tolerates 15 minutes of screaming while I like brush my teeth and stuff and get ready to bed. And then I go to bed and I feed Theo and then he just like cuddles it up in the crook of my arms and put his like fat little head on my shoulder and just like falls asleep. And it's like the cutest thing and is why my shoulder is all out of whack. And then we like sleep like that until morning. And Ella wakes up at like 1 or 2 at night and like comes to our bed on a bad night. On a good day, she comes at 6. And so I just wake up with, like, you know, any number. I've had any number of days where I was like, shit, where's Theo? And he's just where I left him. Or I'm like, oh, Theo's right here. And then it turns out to be Ella. And, like, it's, you know, it just...
You, like, replace him for, like, a lamp or something. Like, he's, like, yeah, in the bookshelf.
Yeah, well, they... It's a good thing we invested in a king-size bed, because otherwise there would be no room for me or Promise.
But you could prevent them from growing.
We tried stunting them, but they you know, they just want to
eat. They keep growing.
Yeah, so that's...
Those elaborate quarantine meals aren't helping then.
Well, so, Ella will only eat candy, so that helps.
You'd like that. Maybe that cake with Jolly Ranchers would be excellent for her.
Yeah.
That'd be a good job. But I let myself do more elaborate things as, like, a little treat. Like, yesterday, I finished kind of a goal I had, and so I spent the rest of the day, I made some bread and tortillas and cornbread and oat milk.
On the Ella only eating candy bit, I know my daughter likes candy, but I found that if I call a food or a drink special or call food candy when it's not. So I got from Trader Joe's some, like, dried mango slices. They're not sweetened or anything. And I tell her they're candy. And I mean, there's sugar in it because it's fruit, but she's like, I'm a candy dad.
This is, like, step one of a 5-part process where it's like you're one of those parents that, like, tricks the kids by, like, getting, like, the box of the name brand cereal and then putting the, like, store brand cereal into the box of the name brand cereal.
Definitely. I have to say that one of my favorite food moments was we decided to keep our daughter busy by buying cupcake mixes, which she could at least stir together, you know, mostly, and required some work from us. But we had a Tupperware with this green lid of cupcake batter just sitting in the fridge, which Ira had enjoyed eating some of, just the batter. Anyway, she comes in. I had seen her with that earlier in the day, and then she comes in. Me and my wife are, like, watching TV, and I saw Ira lift up this Tupperware with the green lid. And she was like, Daddy, can I have this? And I was like, you have to ask your mom. So I thought it was cupcake batter. And my wife's like, why are you not letting her have that? And I was like, it's a lot of sugar. She had peas. I just thought it was really funny because I was, like, all grumpy, and she wanted to eat peas. Like, one of her favorites right now.
So Theo is obsessed with basically getting everything that Ella has, and Ella has very sophisticated taste. So her current obsession is tonic water, like the expensive kind that you get in the little bottle, and she likes it in, like, little cocktail glasses from green glass that we have,
and fancy. So
she is very fancy, and so she likes that. But then Theo now is obsessed with every beverage that he's not allowed to drink. So his two favorite things are coffee and beer. And so whenever I have a mug, he's like, I have to have this. And whenever anyone has a can, he's like, I must have this. And it's really bizarre. It's like he has a honing beam, and it doesn't, like, matter what we do or where we put it. He just goes straight at it. So we consume our caffeine and alcohol very quickly now. We should change gears a little bit. So the first thing we should do is congratulate Cassie and Sam, because technically today is graduation day.
Yay. Yeah, I have to figure out how the...
Oh, wait, I have appropriate reaction.
You have, do you take a little hat next to you and just throw it up in the air?
Oh, wait. Right.
Oh, I don't know how to take it off. Sorry, that's my reaction forever.
My cap never... Yeah, it just
it's mine.
Like 15 seconds. My cap never arrived, so I had forgotten to... The reason we're in temporary housing is, of course, we moved from Houston to Plano, and I forgot to change my university, like, official address, and so I don't know if I'm ever getting my cap, but...
I would argue that this might be a blessing in disguise, because I don't know... For me, graduation ceremonies are just the worst. You stand there and you just, in, like, the hot sun in, like, the middle of summer, and you just listen to someone, like, read a phone book.
I'm with you. I think my mom is really disappointed that this is. So this was for her. Like, today they threw a graduation party for me. I have to sit through both the liberal arts graduation at 3 today and the university commencement at 9.
My mom is also wanting to watch the live stream, which I'm not too keen on, but yeah. I've never actually had a graduation because I homeschooled myself, like, the last couple years of high school. So I never, like, walked the stage or anything. And then now I don't get to do it for my bachelor's, and so like my whole family's just kind of like really disappointed about that.
That is such a bummer. I'm really sorry for all you guys graduating this year, honestly. Even if you think it's hokey, it's a thing you only get to do once. Yeah. And so it's nice you're commemorating it in some way, but I think it's a bummer. I can't thumbs down reaction. So
I'm happier with the like at home thing my family did than I would have been for walking across.
But that at least sounds more personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the AC and not in the like pea-like stew that is the, I don't know why, but UT always graduates on like the most humid day.
Yeah, I've been to friends' graduations before. And then that was when I decided I do not want to participate in this for myself. Yeah.
Do they still read all the names?
Oh yeah. Oh well, they have like they read the names of the like college level graduations. So you have like the liberal arts has their own graduation, but not all the departments, right? Like psychology and like the big units have separate graduations, because otherwise it's like even this way it takes 2 or 3 hours. And then there's a big graduation which is normally at the tower, and that's where you have your commencement address and the president speaks and they have the fireworks.
And it's a different day, like it's two days or same
it's a
day?
2 day event. So the graduation ceremonies start on a Saturday, right? And then Sunday evening is, or do they start on a Friday and then Saturday evening? But it's like, it's a 2 day shebang to fit everyone in. And inevitably every other year, there's like a massive storm and they cancel the fireworks. And then graduate convocation is basically, you know, you guys like arrive in the crack of dawn to be herded into the stadium. And then you sit there for hours while the faculty like trolls in. And then, like you do the graduation, and actually your supervisor is just like hovering in the wings awkwardly. And then you get your hook'em shot against like a tiny like tower like background.
It's like a prom photo, right? It's like you kind of stand
well,
in front of like a...
literally the picture is like a like an 8x10 that's like, you know, up on with like painter's tape, and you like get in front of it and you do your hook'em and they snap it.
Do you get to ride Bebo as part of the the process?
No. Bebo, like the endowment, is not for you. But anyway, the fact that Sam and Cassie are graduating is, I think, what initially gave us the idea for this episode, because a lot of people are kind of, you know, figuring out their next step, and a lot of the next steps are more uneasy or unsettled in these days. So we thought we would talk about that. So Colin, maybe we should start with you, because you are the closest. Well, I guess Naomi's closest to the job market, having just escaped. It's
just on the other side of it. It's much probably nearer to her, you know, her hearts and minds.
But Colin, so you are about halfway, well, you're most of the way through your dissertation. So do you want to tell us how the Mellon Fellowship works and kind of your hopes and prayers for the
next? It's a lot of it is also, it's like kind of in a state of renegotiation right now, part of which I'm not very privy to, because I sort of have been just sort of walling my, like, just really kind of like hunkering down in a lot of ways, and like emails these days I kind of glance at, and then just, you know, I make a 5-second decision if I'm going to read it or not, and most of the time I don't. But so like for the process for me is I'm on an original deadline. The deadline for me was end of August. Like I had a hard deadline that everything needed to be done with my dissertation, so like graduated and all of that by August 31st. Where I think we haven't heard back, but there's the other sort of the fellows in my cohort with me are, well, obviously you might understand there's a little bit of anxiety about that hard deadline now, particularly because some of them have young children. One of them, I think, is expecting a child. So the idea of that hard deadline is becoming sort of more tenuous. So, but for me, because I'm sort of relatively, I'm pretty unattached. It hasn't really changed. So I sort of am still hoping to make that deadline, finish my dissertation, and have all my sort of I's dotted, T's crossed by the end of August. And then the next stage, which is the postdoc year, is designed around a sort of public-facing scholarship and public-facing projects. And again, I think other fellows in my cohort are affected a lot more, because their public-facing projects involve things like conferences or outreach programs, working with like, say, youth or like people applying to college, things like that. And like, there's an in-person component to theirs, whereas mine is more along the lines of sort of creating op-eds and sort of just public writing. So that so far seems, so I'm sort of uniquely unaffected by that. But next year is also in the sort of, in the world without the coronavirus is the year that I need to be going through the regular job, the job hunt. So applying and then doing the meetings and the interviews, hopefully, and things like that.
And how about your, you haven't really had library access. Did you already have just most of your materials out? Or have
sort of a funny story, because I actually, up until like yesterday, I wasn't even able to get into the Wagner building, because like I it was a long email chain with Leighton, our building manager. And I had been left off the list of like they were going to grant all the graduate students access to WAG. And I just, like, for whatever reason, my name like did get onto the list. So I went a couple of times to try and get into WAG, because I still had some books in my office that I needed to get. I had like most of my materials sort of already checked out or scanned. Fortunately, I'm like standing here. You can't really see it, but I'm standing like surrounded by these like piles of books, and like, it's just like all over the room. So I have most of my, every now and then there's like, I still have some footnotes that I've highlighted that's like a page number that I just like need to get this page number, and I don't know. I like, don't know. I need to like start asking people, like, do you have like, you know, De Jong's commentary on the Iliad? Because I just like made a little note to myself. So I just, as of yesterday, was able to get into Wagner and get the books in my office.
Do grad students not have a key to the building?
No, they changed all the physical locks.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So they, yeah, normally I actually, there's like a card, there's like one of the doors has like a little card reader, and you can just go in. And I always use the other, because I have this whole process sort of worked out of when I need to like quickly and sneakily get into Wagner. Right? So they changed all the hard locks on Wagner, like for the physical keys. So it's only the card reader door is the only way we can get in now.
I'm no longer a student. If they change the locks, how will I get into the building now?
I have stuff in my office that I need to get. And I don't know how, and also library books to return, which I guess I can return at any book drop, but I prefer to use ours.
And so Sam and Cassie, you're both also the leadership of, or the outgoing leadership, I guess, of A Sigma Phi. So is there a transition of power that you were supposed to?
Yeah, we managed to have Cassie ran our kind of elections online, and those still worked out well. We need to find a time to Zoom with the incoming officers and share our email passwords and Venmo information and all the different, like, the president has to go to this meeting and that meeting in order to stay registered as an organization. And so fill them in on all of that. But I think that went relatively seamlessly. They're also in a situation where they'll have a little bit more money next year than normal, because we tend to break even each year with some fundraisers, but then we hold monthly events, taking faculty out to dinner and having an end of year banquet and things like that. So the money we raised in the fall hasn't really been spent. But yeah, I think the organization was, other than not being able to hold its events, was for next year is unaffected. They're in a good position. So, but our office uses our key to the office also unlocks that back door closest to that one-way street. And so I used to like be able to come in on weekends and open the building. And now I suppose I can't. Not that I live in Austin or have any real occasion to, but...
you just like, yeah, you just like leave little like traces of your memory around the building.
Yeah, well, I've got boxes of books in the office because I bought some IKEA bookshelves for my room in my apartment, but I still like had overflow. And so I brought like some of the, like my Hanson and Quinn or my OCD or the kind of books that I were like, oh, I can argue that these are maybe useful to more people than just me. So let me store them in the office.
Maybe we can, whenever you come back to move your stuff, we can pop by and figure out a way to break in or something.
Yeah, hopefully our student IDs still work. Like,
I mean, yeah, one sure of they us didn't, could like, just yeah. let you in.
So, Bill, you are in, like, an odd kind of in the middle. I never know which year anyone is. You're a fourth year?
This stops mattering after, like, two or three.
I like that. Right?
You could say, no, I'm in my, I just finished the second year.
It's the second year?
Yeah. I still have a year of classes left.
You're unusually mature, Bill.
I'm a little older. I'm maybe the oldest grad student.
No.
Well, a second. Yeah.
Yeah, you're definitely not the oldest, but
I'm not the oldest, but I'm I'll be 33 this August.
It's not a competition. Wait, how is this just the second year?
Because I applied 2 years ago and started last year.
Are you Bill, I wonder, are you being conflated with prior grad students? Is you're also,
I don't know.
There's an unbroken line between you and similar enough graduate students that that's all just one seamless tether?
Maybe. I mean, if I let, if you want to petition an department and get me out of the rest of my exams and coursework, that's fine with me. Yeah.
I mean, I don't, I mean, you were in my survey. It just seems so long ago that,
yeah, it was
like, surely.
2 falls ago. Yeah.
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 Wow. I mean, to be honest, after a while, all of you just like,
yeah,
blending in. But also, like, our, because our program is a bit fluid in its milestones, then yeah, it is hard to keep track of who is in kind of,
yeah,
what year. But still, second year is respectable. But so you are taking classes and, yeah, teaching, right? And you, I know, have just held down masterfully the large myth course. And you're starting to think about a dissertation project and sort of all of the rituals of kind of passing into.
Yeah.
So how has, you know, hanging out at home with your toddler messed all of that up?
Yeah, I'm really lucky in the fact that in our program, we have a set of 8 different types of courses every student has to take. So I had to take 2 history-themed courses, 1 material culture, 1 outside the department, et cetera. And these are like really fluid boundaries for what that means. But I was really determined to get all of those specific types of courses done in my first 2 years, which kind of led to funny instances where I'd be with Professor Rigsby, my advisor, and he'd be like, okay, all of these courses you're taking, you're not taking a single literature course, although that's your best interest. And I'm like, yeah, I just want to get these requirements out of the way so that I can get started on the dissertation. So I've been really lucky in that way. That means going into my next year, the only wrinkle is I'm the only student, I think, who was affected by this, but we had a change in my first year where we were doing the Greek and Latin lit surveys each year, but I took Latin my first year, and then they offered Latin again in my second year, not Greek. So I'll be doing that next year. But the nice side of that is that I really just want to have a class where I read a lot and don't have to write a whole bunch except for the exams accompanying with it. So I'll be reading that. I'll be in ILET, your survey,
oh, yes,
your course.
I saw that, yeah.
And then my plan, which Rigsby was good with, is I'm just going to do some independent studies. So at least right now, in the fall, my third course is going to be an independent study with Dr. Beck, working on an old paper, and I'll at least get that done for the portfolio, and I'm going to look at prospects for that paper of the dissertation, but we'll see how that goes. I'm also doing an independent study with Pramit, Ailet's husband, this summer. That's just to say...
Does he know this?
Yeah, he does. Okay. I don't know if he told you. Yeah.
It exists in writing somewhere.
It's in emails. Well, I have it in emails. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it's just, you say that, but probably email structure, hi honey, is like nothing. It's like a filing cabinet. Like he has every email he's ever sent or received, and it's, whoa, in this like elaborate hierarchy of files, and I mean, it's incredible. So like, if it's an email, it is definitely there. Whereas I am of the, like, my inbox has 8,000 messages in it, going back to like 2009. We're very like...
Just hearing that stresses me out.
I know, well, me too.
Yeah.
Because every summer, I'm like, one of my summer projects would be to finally go through this monstrosity and trim it down. And every summer, something else happens. So, but it is definitely a future project. But yeah, no, Bill, if it's an email, then he knows.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And especially too, because we just keep making jokes about it. Like, oh, there'll be a newborn and you'll be doing all this stuff. And, like, yeah,
on the flip side, it's like when you start getting around to your writing your dissertation, you'll be able to like track the growth of your dissertation next to like the growth of a living person. Like,
yeah,
my dissertation is about as old as Theo, which is kind of a weird thing, yeah, to think about. And like, so it's like, oh, Theo's like, you know, when he starts like talking. And then, like, I'm just, like, waiting for the moment where, like, Theo's intelligence eclipses that of my dissertation.
Well, he's starting to walk, and he can say a book, which is,
yeah,
a bird.
I'm in fear. My writing is already in peril of being outdone.
Well, and also he's, like, a 25-pound behemoth, so...
How old is he? Like 11 months?
11 months. Yeah. He's enormous. Like, it's, I don't know where he gets that from, but
I had an awkward moment in my first year of grad school here. I think it was the spring, and I can't remember who it was, but one of our PhD students who was about to finish her dissertation was talking with, I think, Grace or something, and said something about, like, her baby. And I was like, how old is your child? And she said, I mean, my dissertation.
Yeah.
I was like, my daughter's too.
Yeah. I had a book come out just when Ella was born. It was one of those weird, like, you know, it was the Game of Thrones book, and I wrote it in a kind of panic. And so basically I like, you know, had pregnant brain, like couldn't really do anything. And then in the last trimester, just sat out and pounded like 1,000 words a day until I just got it down, and I submitted the manuscript just before she was born. It was a couple of weeks. And then it basically churned through the production process over my third trimester. And then, which was great because as your like brain gets foggier, you can still proofread, but you can't like produce stuff. But then the book came out shortly after Ella did. And so I was like able to weigh them up against each other. And
like actually weigh the book? No.
Well, the book is not very heavy.
It's not very big.
It was heavier from the get-go. But it was a weird, like, my supervisor had her baby and her book come out at the same time. And she was like, it's kind of weird feeling to have two things that you've worked really hard on kind of out in the world at the same time.
Which one's more eloquent?
Ella. who this morning told me that her shoes can be on the couch because they are responsible for the couch.
They are the masters of their fate.
They are the master of the fate. No, Ella is master of where she surveys. I'm going to, on this note, step off for a second to help Pramit bring them in from the car. So Sam, can you take over?
Yeah. So on the spot, I don't know what to ask.
Would you rather have a cat with a human face or a dog with human hands?
Mm. Cat with a human face.
But then it could really scowl at you all day long, dismissively.
Yeah.
No, I think it's great. What we do in the shadows is where the dude has a human face on a cat, and it gets me every time.
You can never get the faces right.
Right, yeah.
I've been watching the new, because the TV show, the second season's like coming out right now. So
it's so good. For anyone who doesn't know what We Do in the Shadows is, it's a vampire mockumentary produced by Taika Waititi and Jemaine Clemens from Flight of the Conchords.
Like, yeah, it's very New Zealand.
Hey, Theo.
He just
woke up.
Those headphones are getting ripped right out.
Yeah. Can you wave? If you wave at him, he will wave back.
He's looking, he's just like, peasants.
I just woke up. Yeah, and my coffee mug is here, so obviously he's going straight at it. Can you wave?
There, is he waving there or reaching for the mug?
That's a wave. That's a wave.
Yeah.
You can tell because it's just desperate.
Now he's reaching for the mug.
Yeah. I guess what happens is, like, say he, like, gets a sip of coffee, will he just realize, like, no, I hate this, actually?
No, he'll probably be like, this is great. I have even more energy. I will never sleep.
that's all we need is, like, a caffeinated toddler.
Yeah, a caffeinated, yeah. He does not need caffeine.
I kind of miss when my nieces were babies. They're both old enough to, you know, really get on your nerves at the deepest level. It's unfortunate. When they were babies, they were so cute. Quiet.
Yeah, he just turned 11 months old like a couple days ago, and it made me realize that I have one more month of having a baby around, and after that he's technically not a baby anymore, and I'm like,
I should say my nieces are still cute in case, for whatever reason, my brothers and sisters-in-law watch it. your children are cute.
We love all children. Sorry, where were you when I...
We were talking about...
He didn't formulate a question yet.
Okay.
So what would you like to know about the job market? Well, my job market was not truly affected in the same way, right? Because you apply, let's say, most things are due in December of the year before in the early market. Some things November, some things October, but let's say, you know, last calendar year. Then you have many of your first round interviews at the SCS annual meeting, so the first weekend of January. Some are online. So this is not a hard and fast rule, but this is generally how the job market goes. And the SCS is the Society for Classical Studies. It's just an annual meeting where classicists across North America all unite in one place. It's just as exciting as it sounds, which is very and not at the same time. But it's an opportunity for people to share their scholarship and also to network with other scholars. Graduate students, a lot of graduate students go, and some undergraduates actually go as well. Most of the papers are given by graduate students and professors, but there's a special panel for undergraduates. There's also just networking opportunities, which is always nice. So at this meeting, it used to be the vast majority of first-round interviews would happen, where kind of the long list of all the applicants, anywhere from, I would say, 8 to 12 people get interviewed, sometimes more, you know, up to 15, sometimes, I don't think any less than 8, would take place face-to-face with a committee from each school interviewing people. And from that, a shorter list is drawn, which usually 3 to 4, which are then invited on campus for the second round of interviews. So for me, this happened this past January, which was before coronavirus really hit. So I was able to go to the meeting. Obviously, the online first round interviews were unaffected. And then when I went to my on-campus interviews, those all took place mainly in February.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of I think I was done by March with my on-campus interviews. So at that point, I didn't have to travel anymore. And that's right when everything started getting weird, was like the first couple of weeks of March, because I was actually invited to give a talk as part of this lecture series called Classics and the Global at the University of Pittsburgh, which is it's a pretty cool lecture series, just kind of how classics or themes of classics, texts and classic ideas and classics can speak to these greater global issues. So things like immigration or racism or all these other trade economy things can be relevant from classics. So either way, I went to that, and that's right when the coronavirus thing started. So my interviewing process was pretty unaffected. And the way the job market works, the bulk of long-term tenure track positions are released in that first round. And then after those get filled, when there's some movement within institutions, is when they release temporary positions, which might be for a year to 3 years. And those come out in the spring. So I think that bulk of jobs is what got really affected. They started canceling some positions, not as many as I thought that they would, which was good. That didn't directly affect me. Yeah. So how do I get to Austin? My plan was, I went to UPittsburgh. Eventually, you know, I worked out my contract with Austin, with the University of Texas at Austin. And I was like, okay, well, we'll take a couple of weekends and go see some neighborhoods and see the department again and say hi and plan how we're going to move and what neighborhood we'll live in. We'll visit childcare centers. We'll be put on the list for the UT childcare center, but we'll also look at other ones because, for those of you who don't know, apparently getting a child into a daycare spot is kind of like the Hunger Games. But
800
that all,
people. The waiting list, 800 people long.
Whoa.
So that
it took us a year.
Yeah.
Over a year.
Is the baby
did you get
already?
Into the UT?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Is the baby in as well?
The first thing I did was put this new, the new baby's on the waiting list, basically. Okay. Yeah. But the
so
first
that's
thing
a
I
big
did
thing was, for me too now. I don't know how that list works. Yeah. I'm allegedly on the list. But yeah, if you have an email to just kind of check, but I'm sure they just have no idea when they're going to open or how that's even going to work or how many people are going to want their spots, right? Mm. Might be more, might be less. I don't know how it's going to look like in the post-COVID world.
Yeah,
so
I can see that going either way.
Bit. Yeah, exactly. It could go either way. So this transitional bit is kind of what's been most affected by the pandemic, something you never expect when going on the job market or starting a new position. It's kind of been not so much the work things, but the things that go around the move, finding a place to live, childcare, putting our own home on the market here in Cleveland. And then, of course, it's kind of interesting, you know, my first department meeting was on Zoom. Not
I'm sorry
typical.
About that.
I think it went fine. It was just kind of, it's a funny thing, you know, when you think about it. And luckily I had met most of the faculty when I went there, which is nice because you have some kind of baseline how people are not in Zoom, because Zoom is a little bit artificial. So those are kind of the things that have affected. For PhD students moving forward, what the job market is going to look like is the big question mark.
Yeah,
like I said, I've seen some positions taken off the market. Which has been disheartening, but on the other hand, it's been fewer than I thought there would be revoked. So that's the good news.
Yeah. I graduated into the, so I got into PhD in 2009, which was right after the 2008 collapse, which has now been dwarfed by this. And you know, when we graduated, people were like, oh, you know, that's, you know, the end, and there will never be jobs again. And I got a bunch of interviews, and then I got the UT job. And in some ways, that was the kind of the last job going, right? So the year I interviewed, there was a reasonable number of jobs, and I have never seen that many jobs again, especially not in Latin. You know, it's kind of, it's weird because it's not, I wouldn't call it anything as explicit as survivor's guilt, but because at first you're so focused on sort of getting to your department and, you know, getting yourself ramped up. And so you get settled in, and obviously your first year on the tenure track is insane because you don't know what you're doing, and every level up in academia ramps up exponentially. So you start out as a tenure track faculty, and suddenly you have like 10 times more work as you think you would have as a graduate student. And then you know, get into associate, and that ramps up even more. And then, so you kind of get through year one and year two, and then you kind of just, and at that point you still feel normal because all your friends are like, you know, maybe someone else got a tenure track job or they're VAPs or something like that. But after 2 or 3 years, it gets weird because some of your friends have given up on the market, or they're still VAPs, or like, and so the gap just kind of grow, and it just starts feeling different, and you become very acutely aware of the amount of privilege you've accrued through luck. And I don't normally like it when people say, oh, well, you know, it's all, because it's not all luck, right? You have to work hard to get to a point where luck would benefit you. But it is kind of striking how many or what big a gap can open just by graduating in a particular year, right? It's not like, you know, had I graduated a year later, I would have been much more in much more difficult circumstances. But because I graduated when I did on this like little bubble right before the field felt the effect of the collapse, then, you know, I'm now an associate professor at an R1, but things could have gone down very differently. And it's something that you don't really feel until a few years later. But I don't know, Naomi, your experience was a bit different because you're kind of more experienced than I was, and you have a family, and, you know, but I don't know, do you get that feeling where you're kind of like, I don't know, it's a very kind of odd feeling because you go through grad school as a cohort, and you think like all of your friends, like you think of yourself as a group, and then suddenly you're just like atomized individual in a.
Yeah, I definitely, I graduated in 2014, but I got my first VAP that academic year, 13-14. So I've been kind of in different positions for a while, and I've seen people, like you said, get tenure track jobs, get eternal VAPs, do ALTAC, or drop out of academia altogether. So I've definitely been part of that. I've been really lucky in that I was willing to have other priorities, and that's part of why I took a circuitous path. But there's definitely an element of timing to it. Like you said, it's not all luck, but luck is part of it. It's definitely like I always think of like Pindar and what he attributes to the victorious athletes. I mean, you need talent, but you need toil. You need a good family lineage, and then you need the gods, right? If you don't have one of those elements, you're not going to be an Olympic victor. And I feel like that's landing a tenure track job. You need to have a PhD. That's your lineage, right? You need to work hard, right? If you're going to slack, it's not going to work out. But if you have that, it still doesn't matter if you don't have that third element of luck and kairos, right, and timing. For me, the timing of the UT job, for example, was perfect this year. It lined up with my wife finishing her residency and me really wanting to go on the market in a big way and look for that permanent position. And I have connections to Texas, the state, not the school. Although I guess if you have connections to Texas, the state, it's also the school, since everyone...
Like the snake farm.
The snake farm.
That was
unless
what put
you're
you
an
over
Aggie,
the...
right? But we're not going to talk about those people.
Ella's daycare teacher next year is an Aggie.
How's that possible?
I don't know. I'm like, I don't know how that will work out. But
that shouldn't be allowed.
It's like insubordination sewn into your own household.
Well, the motto of the daycare is hook 'em young. So
well, they come home and start talking about Aggies. You'll know.
Yeah, we'll have to put a hex on them.
Maybe they're planning to like tip Bevo over if they start training them. No one will suspect like a room full of toddlers.
Yeah, no, that's true.
We're just alienating thousands of potential listeners.
My toddler did come home.
Allison's is a bit optimistic.
Doing hook-ems. They teach him there.
So I'll tell you my proudest moment as a UT parent. I was in a faculty council meeting, and I was standing next to Greg Fenves, our president, and Ella had just learned how to do hook 'em, and she was very good at it. We have a picture of her on the steps outside Wagner doing hook 'em, which we are going to use for the front page of our 40 for 40 fundraiser. And so I was telling Greg very proudly of how my two-year-old daughter can do the hook 'em, and he says, you know, my granddaughter is two-year-old too, and we've been trying to teach her, but she just won't do it. And I was like, yeah.
Actually, for my graduation notices that I'm going to be sending out at, you know, an undetermined time in the future once I get pictures taken, on the back where there's like a little spot for like a smaller picture, and I actually found when I was going through my mother's photos a picture of me when I was 4 at my older brother's UT graduation wearing his cap and doing the hook'em. And so I thought that would be really cute to put on my grad notice as like a, you know, 20 years later kind of.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But our family's like a huge UT family, and you learn how to hook 'em from a very young age.
So yeah, to answer your question, definitely, you know, it's hard to see people going through all that. I think as an undergraduate, very early on, I had an advisor who kind of already, even before the 2008 crash, just was really frank about the academic job market. So even before, I mean, now it's, I think 20% of humanities PhDs get tenure track jobs. It might be even lower now. But back then it probably was a little bit higher, but he was still very frank. So in some ways I kind of had more appropriate expectations by the time I went to grad school. And that way, when the crash happened, and it definitely affected the job market a lot more, I think that I had maybe different expectations than some people. And then our department at the University of Washington was also pretty early to realize how bad this was affecting the job market and what that would mean. I think perhaps some other places didn't, but their advising took, you know, advisors took that into account and thinking about what was going to happen and maybe what kind of planning to have. But it's definitely, you know, sometimes you see people on the market forever and you know that they're smart, good, hardworking people and would be great colleagues. And then some other people get a job and it doesn't really seem to square with that. So there are those moments when you're like, how does that work out? And you do have a bit of, I mean, survivor's guilt is a good phrase for it, I think. If you know you have friends or colleagues from your cohort or just other grad students, friends you've made along the way that you think that really want this, right? That is their number one priority. They don't want an alt-act position or they don't want to do something else with it. And then you get your tenure track job and you still see them in VAPs or deciding whether to leave the field or not. It can be pretty tough. Yeah. So, I totally agree with you. It's just there's no easy answer to that.
Well, and conversely, right, some people transition out of academia really successfully and they're super happy and they make more money than us and they have, you know, they can choose where they live and sometimes it solves their two-body problem and then you're just thinking, well, am I doing the right thing? Like, am I, you know, commuting for 7 years and like putting up with all of this in order to be slightly looked down on by, you know, pretty much everyone. So, I mean, it's a weirdly emotional process to kind of go through. And then at some point you hit, like where I am now, my friends are all either in tenure track positions or in situations where they're either happy in or kind of settled in. And so there is a feeling that we've all kind of arrived somewhere and, you know, the rest of our lives are kind of, you know, just doing more of the same, right? We're all ready for our midlife crisis. But yeah, the period in between is a strange and bewildering journey.
Yeah, the lack of settling, I think, that's a good way of putting it. And that's part of what makes it a difficult period is if you feel like you're not in where you're going to be permanently.
Yeah.
Right. Some people can feel stifled by that, right, when you're stuck in a situation. But the flip side is if you don't know where you're going to be permanently, it can feel hard to put down roots.
Yeah.
Whether that be in a type of profession or literally for us, that means a city a lot of the time.
And it's you know, you don't really get that until tenure. And so you're in this weird position where your life is literally divided in 6-year periods, right? Because you go to grad school and you're usually there for about 6 years and then you go on the job market and you know, once you get your tenure track job, you're there for 6 years. And then at some point, you're just like, like for us, at some point, I was like, I guess I'm Texan now, right? Like, I have tenure, I have a house, my kids are in daycare, and suddenly you're like, wow, I am the establishment.
Your kids are
like,
doing the hook'em?
Yeah, they're doing
you're done. Yep.
Only one of them. So, like, we have an out. But, yeah, it's weird because you spend so long. I think one of my colleagues said when they got tenure that it's like being in a crouch for a really long time, and it takes a while to, like, train your muscles to stand up straight. So it's, you know, fun stuff. But Sam, my dear, you have chosen this dark time to enter grad school, and you will soon be gracing the hallowed hall of what building is it?
The Kelsey Museum.
You're going to Michigan to do IPCA. So as you listen to kind of Bill and Colin talk about grad school, and me and Naomi, or Naomi and I rather, talk about the other side of things, how are you feeling about your decision?
Well, rank your dread on a scale of 1 to 10.
I guess I obviously haven't started yet, so some of what I think of as, oh, I'm being prepared and realistic, I guess, has yet to be put to that test. But I also feel like I've had enough conversations with grad students and faculty over the years that I, even before, I mean, this conversation, I think I have a good idea of what I'm getting into, or at least notionally. But yeah, no, I think similar to Naomi, the application process was mostly unaffected, although there was that time kind of in early April where I hadn't heard back yet. And as everything was starting to shut down, I was like, is that going to affect things? Will I hear back? But luckily it worked out. And I think now we're going to see how next year works. But kind of getting an apartment in Ann Arbor without actually being there was a little bit challenging. But yeah, no, I think more I'm nervous for not the grad school itself, although plenty of nerves about that. But I guess similarly, the job market afterwards, how will this affect that in 6-ish years? So, but yeah.
That's one of the sort of nice things. Maybe this is it's a bit of an ostrichy strategy, but one of the kind of nice things about grad school is like, you kind of like, at least for me, it can always be like I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. Like there's always a more immediate bridge for you to deal with. Like, first yeah. step being like just classes and settling in and moving and figuring out. So like what the job market is going to be like in 6 years might be, you know, might keep you up at night, but like there's more immediate problems at the very least to like keep yourself occupied.
Yeah, that's future Sam's problem to deal with.
Well, yeah, and I have the relationship with future Colin where I'm like, well, like F that guy, like that's his problem.
Yeah.
Like when I buy plane tickets, I'll be like, yeah, 5 a.m. flight, no trouble. That's future Colin's problem.
Yeah, and future Sam hates present Sam.
Yeah, exactly, for sure.
But yeah, no,
definitely,
I think
more pressing things now, like you said, Colin. I think also more nice things.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. There's really challenging parts about grad school that keep you up at night right now that you have to deal with. But that's also a particularly special time that you'll never have this kind of opportunity again. And some of that you're like, thank God I never have to do that again. But in other ways, it's never going to happen again. And so, you know, I would say it's not only about just ignoring bad things that may or may not occur in the future, but it's also about sort of being present and being able to enjoy the stuff you can do in grad school and what you're getting paid to do, which is to learn and teach, which is a pretty fun thing.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited. I get to sign up for classes here in a week or two, and I'm definitely looking forward to it. So.
A really great job, and like Isla and Naomi were saying, like there is an element of like toil and hard work and luck and the gods and all that, but it can be a really sort of good, like this is, I probably won't have a job after this that is as accommodating for me, at least right now.
Yeah, I guess I was I also just want to say, like, you know, appreciate what it is as an end in itself instead of just a means to an end.
Yeah,
because I think worrying about the job market can be an endless worry, an endless pit of despair and time, right? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't sound like what you're doing at all, Sam. So I'm not saying this particularly to what you said. I mean, you kind of said like, yeah, that's future Sam's problem. And I think that's a good attitude to take about it. But it's not just being an ostrich, I guess. I want to defend your point of view by saying it's also saying, well, that's the next stage. My stage now is this grad school stage. And that can lead to all sorts of things. And maybe I want it to lead to this particular path, but at least there's an end to itself in it right now to appreciate.
At,
le-
I'd say too that I don't think is quite has been said, but I think going into grad school right now can be a pretty good position, because who knows what will happen 6 years from now? We don't know, but
I've got friends who are either not planning on pursuing grad school but doing something else, or else. I think so. Cassie, you're planning to go to grad school but decided not to apply for this coming year, and so I guess in some ways I'm fortunate that I'm in whatever happens in grad school or after. Like I know what I'll be doing for the next 6 years.
There's a security built in already, what you've got.
Whereas I think it was Princeton's sociology program recently decided they're not taking PhD candidates for next year. And I think that especially as we transition, as soon, like when classes start up in the fall again, and we realize exactly how this is going to affect things on an ongoing basis. Whereas I think at the moment, we're at least still optimistic, which, I mean, maybe we should be, I don't know. But I think more and more programs will kind of delay or at least alter how that looks. I'm very fortunate that I'm here. I have friends who are going out on the job market right now, on the non-academic job market, but and are struggling to find positions that are what they want to do. And so I'm by no means complaining.
So Cassie, what's your kind of view? Because you're going to sit this one out, right? And are you dead set on graduate school, or are you thinking, now that I've heard you lot, no way?
No, well, I can't remember exactly what semester it was, but we had Eta Sigma Phi put on a graduate school, like, sort of conference, like mini conference within the department, where we just had a bunch of the department's like faculty and graduate students talk to us about, you know, graduate school, if you don't go to graduate school, like, you know, what to expect, how to be prepared, and like all of that. So I've already been through that round of fear mongering, and I still wanted to do it. And I only plan on being out of it for a year. Like the reason that I decided to take a gap year was because I just felt overwhelmed with everything that was going on, like with school, because I was working on a thesis, and I've never taken less than 15 credit hours in a semester. So I've just always had like a very full plate. And I just felt that I could put together a better application if I had time to only focus on that. So that's my reason for waiting, but I am definitely, definitely set on going to grad school.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big decision, right? I mean, I think I told you, Colin, when we started talking about your dissertation, that you want to pick a topic that you really like because you'll be stuck with it for 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And it's true for grad school as well, right? You want to pick somewhere that will like support your interests and be a nice place to live, and where you like the people, because you'll be stuck there for 6 to 8 years. So it's like, it makes really good sense to kind of take that decision slowly and make sure that, yeah, it's a commitment, right?
Yeah. Cassie, I think that's smart what you're doing. I think it's really smart, because at the very least it's a good way to sort of be sure it's what you want, because there is like a sort of, I mean, there's also a lot of sense to kind of keeping the momentum going straight into grad school, but there's also some set of like trying something else for a little bit, because there's like kind of a latent fear of like, this is what's been dominating my thought for the last 4 years, you know, am I just sort of being like caught up in the stream. And like I took 2 years, something like that, maybe more, between undergrad, and I didn't think I wanted to go to grad school as an undergrad, and then came to the decision later, and that had its own sort of like, I was very much I like didn't know who or what anything was when I came in, and it took a couple years to catch up, but I think it was really nice to just like have experienced life outside academia, which I think also translates really well to just once you're in academia, to have like outside experiences.
I'd just jump onto that, Cassie. I took 6 years off. I did undergrad and got into a master's program, luckily right after that. But I taught middle school and high school for 6 years. And the whole time I was hoping to go to grad school. But I think my own grad school experience is way better than it would have been, because I came in with a lot more focus and a lot more drive, knowing what I wanted to get out of it, but also having the time in between to say I wanted to get my Latin and Greek better. So I had chances to read a lot more Latin and Greek. So it can be a really good time to figure those things out.
Yeah, I'll third that at this point. I took some time off in between, and I've actually taken some time off after I've graduated and been a teaching professor. I took some time and went and taught high school, for example. And this semester, you know, I'm at home with my baby, and all these different times away have, for me, really galvanized the fact that I want to be in academia. So some people know and can just jump right in, or you know, you seem to know as well, Cassie, but you still want to have some time in between. But I think, yeah, there's no reason to fear time off. Think if it's what you want to do, it can be good for all the reasons hitherto outlined.
Okay. We should be wrapping up. So
One thing about the pandemic I'll just randomly say is that I worry my baby doesn't know humans exist except for me and my wife.
To be fair, so, if he's 6 months old, he doesn't know humans exist other than you and your
himself.
Wife.
Himself.
Yeah. Well, you could also create this, I mean, it may not be old enough, but like create this like the sense that he actually lives in like a dystopian world, and then he's like lives in a bunker and can't ever leave the bunker, and then he's going to have this like, I don't know, gaslighting experience where he goes outside, like, he's like, wait a minute, there's like people out here? I thought they all
like
died.
Like the indomitable Kimmy Schmidt. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we're actually probably going to make a pod with another, or a quarantine, as one might say, with another couple and a kid that would allow to see each other and play. They also have a 4-month-old.
I thought you were proposing like a Superman situation, like you were going to launch the baby to another planet to like rescue that planet.
A pandemic free.
Yeah. As our planet descends to chaos.
You know, parents often think about pod projecting situations, and you're just like, I just want a quick like round the world. Like I just need 10 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. They can come back, but
yeah. Yeah.
A couple orbits first.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for inviting me on. This has been nice to get to know people a little bit more also in this weird time. So I appreciate that, even though Sam and Cassie, you guys are leaving. But maybe you'll be back to visit.
Oh, yeah.
I hope so.
I'll potentially be around. Adam said something about stuff he had for me to work on. So you'll see more of me.
Yeah, and we have Sam's books hostage, so he'll have to
come back. That's true. I have to come back. Yeah.
Thanks for letting me come on and ruin it with weird anecdotes.
I know. Thank you, Colin, for agreeing like literally in the nth hour. I texted Colin, was like, so how would you like to be on this podcast?
I was sleeping in this morning and I heard my phone blowing up and I checked out. I'm like, all right, let's like let me shower.
Let's do this. But thank you, and thank you, Bill and Naomi, for taking
a
break from your child life.
Well, thank you guys.
All right, guys, thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Stay safe, everyone.
It is a weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye.